Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Friday, May 15th, 2015. It's just before 5 UTC as we're recording this. I'm Sam Minter, but we don't have Yvonne Bo today. Yvonne is on vacation at Disneyland in Florida.
Disney
Bruce,
World.
Disney World. See, and I thought, I was like, okay, and I got it wrong. Yeah, and I still have not been to either Disney myself.
Yeah. Oh.
One day, someday, maybe. In any case, so as you can hear, we have Bruce with us again, who's co-hosted a few times, filling in for Yvonne before. So welcome, Bruce. Thanks for joining us again.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed all the time, whenever I listen and or participate.
And
Disney World is wonderful. You definitely need to go there. I've never been to Disneyland, but as a kid, I grew up in Florida, and going to Disney World was like something fun you did on the weekend.
Yeah, well, I noticed like this is like the second time in recent months that Yvonne's been there. I think so. It's like, oh, okay, you're going again. But it's practically local. Why not? You know.
Well, I lived in Boca Raton for many years, and it's just a 3-hour drive.
Yeah, so I trust he's having fun there with his family, and he'll be with us again next week. And we do have some real topics today, and I'll mention those in a second. I did want to say one sort of family thing first before we get there. One development this week is my son has started riding his actual bike with pedals this week. And he's very excited about that. And every
no
day,
training wheels.
Still training wheels, but he's moved up from. He had one of these push bikes that you just use with your feet that he'd outgrown like a long time ago. But he was resistant to go to the bigger bike. Like he's had the bigger bike for over a year, but we couldn't get him on it for more than a few seconds at a time. And then suddenly, at some point this week, he decided he was going to get on it. He was going to pedal. He was going to do the thing. And so now, basically every day after I get home from work, he's got the bike out and wants to go and around the neighborhood or whatever. And he's still working on it. Like if he's going uphill, he needs a push. But he's been very excited about this and. That's cool. I like that. My my daughter didn't start riding her bike until age 7. So he's doing it at 5. So
The thing about those training wheels is that they actually are add a lot of danger, because if he's driving or riding on anything that's uneven, like side to side, it's just going to tip him over.
Yeah, no.
And
so far we're going very slow on flat surfaces, basically. I remember training wheels from when I was a kid too, and it's also a question of like you psychologically start feeling like you need them, and then it might actually delay you taking them off. We'll start broaching this topic of removing them before too long. But
What you can do is you can gradually raise them so that they're higher and higher up.
Yep. And then you start working on the balance, and you can ride without them. Yeah. We'll definitely be working on those things slowly. But, at the moment, he's still going really slow and deliberately. And, give it a little bit of time, and then we'll start doing those kinds of things. But
I have a quick question for you. I've been wanting to ask online on the air. Last couple of weeks, I've been thinking, I wonder if Sam would accept advertisements on his show. And the kind of advertisement that I would like, I'm not sure you might want to have, but I was thinking of recording my own Rand Paul political ad and insert and actually paying you to run it on the show.
I would have to discuss this with Yvonne, but we'll consider it. I mean, we're looking at various things to do, and as you've noticed, I'm sure we're doing a little bit of promotion on Facebook, and we're going to be thinking about some other things. We haven't seriously thought about advertising at this point, just because we're so small. I figure we have to have a certain critical mass before it's really worth it to do those kinds of things. But hey, if you're offering, we will certainly consider the proposal, and go from there. The other thing is we've got some, you know, if we got big enough, we got some questions about sort of licensing of the music I use at the beginning and end that we have to sort of clean up. You know,
I've wondered about that. If because you're using only a snippet, if it's,
I don't know the, you know, full, you know, ramifications of that. I've been sort of relying on that we only use a short little couple seconds, but if we ever got to the point where we were having more than a trivial amount of listeners, we'd square that up. We'd either pay whatever licensing fee we needed to pay or stop using that music. Do do do. This is Sam from the future jumping in. Just because we just talked about our opening and closing music and we don't do it anywhere near enough, let me just credit those. Those are both from Ray Lynch. Our opening is The O of Pleasure. And our closing song is Celestial Soda Pop. Those are both from the album Deep Breakfast by Ray Lynch. And, you know, Mr. Lynch, if you happen to be listening to this, you know, we only use a really little bit. And we've always had a little, you know, very small number of listeners. And, you know, so please don't sue us. Please. You know, if it bothers you, you know, we'll do our best to pay up and make it good, and or just stop using it if you'd rather us not use it. Yeah. So, anyway, for those interested, those are the songs, and off we go. Do do do. Anyway, so yeah, we'd consider it. The other one that, you know, you hear a bunch of these, like, you know, like if you listen to a bunch of podcasts, you'll notice, for instance, that Audible is a sponsor on almost everything. And the reason why, mm-hmm. I figured this out because I looked into it a little bit, it's not really, you know, a sponsorship, it's an affiliate thing. And you can go and sign up and become an affiliate, and they basically, you know, they'll go and check to make sure you're not a horribly offensive podcast, I guess, but otherwise you're in, and it's just, you know, you tell people to go sign up at Audible and you get a percentage if anybody actually does. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Yeah. So that's why, you know, almost every podcast in existence has Audible as one of their sponsors, because all you have to do is sign up and you're in. Mm-hmm. But, you know, hey, we're thinking about those kinds of things. But, you know, like I said, we haven't pursued it seriously because we're so small. But if you or anybody else has offers, bring them our way. We'll think about it. And we might cool. do it. So anyway, because, you know, I've got a couple on there. You know, obviously I've got the little singy ones I do, and the things about the show itself, and I've got a couple for there's one for a radio station in Pennsylvania that's run by somebody I knew years ago, yeah, things like that, but nothing real, but anyway, we'll consider it.
Cool.
But we do have a real show coming up, and we've got our three big topics this week are the Seymour Hersh piece on Osama bin Laden and what happened around our killing of Osama bin Laden. We're going to talk a little bit about the Amtrak crash, and, you know, not just the crash itself, which is obviously, you know, hey, it's a tragedy, but some of the issues surrounding that. And then Jeb Bush has had a really bad week this week, just with a bunch of seeming missteps and why would you do that, or how could you, you know, possibly have not already practiced your answer to that question, kind of thing. And we'll talk a little bit about that, and perhaps a few other things going on with the presidential race. And then we'll have our lightning round. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back after this. Da 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 And we're back. So, topic number one, Seymour Hersh, who's been known for a whole bunch of investigative reporting going back to the Vietnam War, put out a new article this last week on details of the Osama bin Laden raid that varied quite a bit from the official story that's been put out. Now, I've read some of the summaries and some commentary and some of the people trying to debunk him and say that, you know, he's basically full of it. And also some of the transcripts of little bits of interviews that he's done with other people. But, you know, I'll be honest here, I did not get a chance to read the entire full article itself. I only read these summaries and things. Bruce, you actually took the time to read the whole thing. So I want to start with you giving the summary of, well, what's going on with this thing? What's this article about? And then we can go from there.
How long do you have? Do you have that timer?
I got the timer going for 15 minutes for this segment.
Okay. I will try to go as pick on the most important parts of it. But basically, this is a 10,000 word article. It's very long, but I have to tell you, it is absolutely essential reading. And I think not only essential reading for those who are interested in this particular topic, but it's a very good lesson about just the innards of politics and covert action and the things that can happen between relationships between countries. It's just an amazing story. And so basically, the thing to know is that everything that you have learned about the killing of Osama bin Laden is a lie. The only things that actually turned out to be true are that Osama bin Laden was killed in Abbottabad by the Navy SEALs. Everything else is pure fabrication. The way that they found out about him, where he was, who knew, the nature of the operation, what they did with his body, it's all different. So just to give it a general rundown, the Pakistanis got bin Laden in 2006. And because bin Laden was hiding in the Hindu Kush Mountains with his wives and children. And the Pakistanis paid off the local tribal people there and found him and grabbed him. And they had him imprisoned in Abbottabad, which is right next to the equivalent of their West Point in Pakistan. And so Osama bin Laden was not hiding out. He was imprisoned and an invalid in that facility. And the way that we found out about it is that we had a $25 million bounty on his head, and someone in the know within the Pakistani military ratted him out. And he's now living, he's not identified in the article, but he's living somewhere in the D.C. area and with his reward. And so once we found out, you know, we wanted to get him because we found out in 2010. And so President Obama wanted to make sure that this wasn't another Jimmy Carter operation where we send in our helicopters and they get shot down or there's a mistake. And so he made sure, well, I could just go on and on and on about this. Mm-hmm. How can I make this shorter? So basically, okay, well, the summary is Pakistan knew that we went in, the ISI. We went in, there was no firefight. Bin Laden was, unable, didn't have any weapons. And so it was basically an assassination. No one else was injured. And there was a cover story that we had agreed with Pakistan that we were going to have, but then we didn't follow that cover story because the politicians decided
the cover story was going to be that we killed him in a drone strike, right?
Yes, exactly. And it was not going to be announced until a week later. And so, but because the politicians were so thrilled about this, they went ahead and just blurted out and came up with a whole different story.
Well, it was also because one of the helicopters did have a mechanical problem and had to be destroyed there or whatever. And so locals noticed something was going on. I mean, if you remember when this happened, there was, you know, just some guy in that town who was tweeting about it. Hey, there's a helicopter over there, you know, in real time. And so they also figured, well, A, like you said, they wanted to announce this because it was a big win. But also they figured there was no way it would stay secret because, you know, the cover was blown at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it turns out that there was no burial at sea. The Navy SEALs, thinking that they were still going to go with the original story that that he would be obliterated a week later, they took his body parts and threw him out the window on the helicopter ride. And so his it's because they shot him up so much with these, I think they're called tumbler bullets. It was body parts that were left, and then there's the whole how the story changed over and over is because the politicians it was a last minute change, just like you said, and I don't understand why they had to make up this elaborate story. Well, I guess I do. I do understand why they had to come up with the elaborate story, but man, I don't know how they could ever think that they could keep it secret.
So there are a couple of elements of this to bring up, and one is, of course, like this all sounds very plausible to me to start with. The fact that the Pakistanis would have had him and then didn't want anybody to know about it, and then if they did give him up, they wouldn't want that public. All of this kind of stuff makes sense. It also makes sense that you put into place cover stories to protect sources and methods, to say, you know, oh, we found out about it this way. Get everybody thinking that, so you don't reveal the actual mechanisms in place. Like, for instance, if in fact it was this guy who gave him up for the reward, presumably now that guy's in danger, you know, of course people knew anyway, like, you know, if this is true, there, you know, people would be,
well, the Pakistanis knew, I mean, the ISI knew,
but presumably there is some value in not giving the truth. But at the same time, it seems like, you know, you could easily enough say he's dead. We're not giving out details. You know, just as easily as you could make up some sort of lie. Now, of course, the other part of this, of course, is that, you know, everybody potentially involved here or potentially as an official source is denying this left, right, and center, saying that, you know, Hirsch is full of it. This is extremely thinly sourced. If you look at the article, it's basically from, you know, one anonymous source with maybe a couple other people.
Well, he said, I listened to a podcast with him, and he has multiple sources, here and in Pakistan. But the only way he was able to corroborate it was by talking to other people, and they basically confirmed what the story that he had gotten from the others.
Now, the other thing that a number of people have brought up, and they applied this, Seymour Hersh also had a story about the chemical weapons attacks in Syria when that happened, basically saying it wasn't actually the Assad administration who did it. It was one of the various rebel groups who did it. And both this story and that story, just as background, Seymour Hersh, for decades, the primary place he's published his big investigatory articles has been the New Yorker magazine. And the New Yorker has very stringent standards on fact-checking and digging into each of their stories and making sure there's double, triple confirmation of everything. And these last two big stories from him, the New Yorker has rejected. And he's gone to other publications that don't have that kind of stringent standard. So that leads people to say, well, you know, maybe he revealed some important stuff in Vietnam, but, you know, how do we know this stuff is really true?
Well, this whole week, if you read the follow-up stories, it's one after another where, oh, yeah, this thing was confirmed and this thing was confirmed. All these different news organizations are going to their sources saying, hey, did this really happen? And so it's being confirmed. And also, I heard in the podcast this morning an interview with Seymour Hersh that
which podcast?
He said that the Scott Horton show.
Okay.
That's the anti-war radio.
Yep.
He said that... that the administration has not actually denied any specific facts or cite or
I believe the actual quote by the administration was, this article is too error ridden for us to fact check it item by item, which of course is, you know,
how convenient.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
well, You can say, because they can't go in and lie anymore, because, you know, the Pakistanis are totally pissed off with them. And so that if they were to come out and say, no, Seymour Hersh was wrong on this, and this, then the Pakistanis can come out and say, well, nope, this we actually will confirm this. And so they don't want to end up with egg on their face. And so.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is also one of the things where I've seen, you know, various people on Twitter that I follow who've been, you know, in the intelligence community, commenters on this stuff. There are two reactions. One, number one, they're all pissed at Seymour Hersh. They're all talking about how, you know, he's known for making stuff up. He doesn't do good research. But at the same time, for the most part, they don't come out and say this is false. They say things like, if you're surprised by the fact that the Pakistanis knew about this, you haven't been paying attention, and various things like that. Well, of course there's cover stories. That's how you do intelligence operations. You always have a cover story, you know? And, so. And the other commentary I mentioned, though, is aside from the fact that, okay, a bunch of people lied, you know, if you fundamentally look at if the Obama administration had come out on the day this happened and given the story they did versus the story as Seymour Hersh tells it, would there actually have been a significant difference in the reaction to what happened here domestically? I can see there being a difference in Pakistan, but domestically, does it really make a difference if we found it out through tracking down a courier and we went in there and had a firefight, or whether somebody came and collected their $25 million reward and then we got them? Like, you would have had the same general reaction from the American public, which, if you remember, for most, you know, I remember at the time having a somewhat different reaction, but enough, you know, there were people celebrating in the streets and, you know, yay, Osama bin Laden's dead. And that would have all been the same. You know, I don't think that this would have come off, you know, better or worse for Obama if they'd come out with Seymour Hersh's story. So it's not in and of itself, you know, scandalous that this is what happened versus what the Obama administration said it happened. It's sort of more that the issue is that, well, why did you make shit up if you made shit up?
Well, I think part of it is that the fact that bin Laden was defenseless.
Well,
it was really more of an assassination.
I think that was... I mean, I know that this story makes that more dramatic, but I mean, I remember even at the time, there were no reports that, you know, that Osama was like, you know, going out guns blazing, you know, the reports even at the time were Osama was found in his bedroom and we shot him, you know, and maybe he was more of an invalid than it was made out at that time. But, you know, it was never made out that he was, you know, some kind of Rambo kind of guy fighting them, you know, and that was one of the reactions. And, you know, I said I had a little bit different reaction. I was like, fundamentally, it didn't sound like there was any reason that they needed to kill him. It was an explicit choice that they were sent in with that mission, because from all descriptions of the raid, and I'm talking about the Obama administration's description of the raid, not even Seymour Hersh's, it sounded like if they had desired to, they easily could have brought him back to the United States alive.
Oh yeah.
And it seems like this is one of those situations where, you know, the right thing to do, quote unquote, from a justice perspective is that kind of thing, is bring him home, put him on trial, see what happens, blah, blah, blah. Of course, from a political perspective, the idea of having, you know, Osama bin Laden in Gitmo or in a jail in New York or wherever for years during some sort of trial process, it is a nightmare from a political point of view, which is why it was probably never contemplated.
Yeah.
You know, so I honestly don't know I don't have a good sense of what the truth really is here. I tend to sort of be inclined to believe Seymour Hersh when I've read his stories before. They have the sort of smell of truth. You know, and I certainly can't confirm his sources. I can't confirm his methods. You know, I don't know for sure that he's not making stuff up, or more likely than him making stuff up, you know, if this is based on only a handful of sources, you know, maybe they're making stuff up. But it certainly has the ring of plausibility.
The way everything is so interconnected on this, about the connections between the, how the Saudis and the Pakistanis and how they and the Taliban and our relationship with the ISI and how it was soured and how it's been getting warmer lately and now this is going to sour it again. It's all this is detailed in an article, and he contrasts the story that the administration told and the various versions of that versus the reality. It's just a fascinating read.
Yeah, and you just mentioned in passing, but from what I understand, is another very intriguing part of this picture is in fact the Saudi involvement in all of this. And that's another political aspect here, that, you know, the Saudis are theoretically our friends in the region, but there's all kinds of stuff they're doing that isn't exactly aligned with our interests, let's say. And so, having that kind of stuff out in the public complicates all of those relationships as well. So, messy stuff. It'll be interesting to see if we ever, you know, hear more or get more confirmation here. This is often the kind of stuff where, you know, somebody like Seymour Hersh will put this stuff out. A lot of people will deny it. And, you know, that's basically where it sits for years and years and years, because, you know, you're never going to get definitive proof one way or another. You're always going to get something arguable, because the people involved, are going to tell different stories, and who you believe is going to be based on who you trust of those people, for the most part. And, you know, every once in a while, like, live physical evidence comes out and it becomes indisputable, but a lot of times these things become, you know, the things that people will still be arguing about 30 years from now.
Yep. Well, I think if the administration were to confirm everything in this story, I don't think Obama would be hurt politically at all about this.
Yeah, either. I mean, he could say, you know, yes, what Seymour Hersh was right, said was correct. We had a cover story in order to protect sources and methods, and the fact that this story has come out has actually hurt our intelligence community in various ways. It may cost lives, and we're sorry it came out, but it's true. You know, and you're absolutely right. He would suffer very little political consequence from that, because the people who would be most likely to go after him for lying are also the same people who would be most protective of the intelligence services and would, you know, respect that, you know, we had to have a cover story line.
Yeah.
So anyway, but
internationally,
or
even further down the hole.
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of mess, you know, with, and this is the same kind of thing as, you know, when all the WikiLeaks memos came out, diplomacy becomes a lot more difficult if what's actually going on is fully public and what everybody thinks about everybody else is fully public. A lot of what happens in diplomacy is the art of, you know, being polite in public when in reality you're doing all kinds of nasty things.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, enough on that topic. We're going to take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit about Amtrak. Back after this. This is Sam here with an opportunity for you. Yes, you heard me right, an opportunity. For you loyal listeners of Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, every once in a while, Yvonne can't make a show. And I do a solo show, which, you know, I think I do okay. But, you know, it's always interesting to have a second person to bounce off. And just in general, sometimes it's good to hear another voice. If you, yes, you, have some things to say about the kinds of things we usually talk about on Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, politics, current events, news, tech, then drop me a line at abelsmay@abelsmay.com letting me know. And hey, I'll keep you in mind and maybe ask if you can join us sometime, either on a regular show with Yvonne if it's something particularly pressing that you maybe have an expertise on, or just, you know, hey, an opportunity to co-host when Yvonne is out. Who knows? Now, I am not guaranteeing that if you send me an email, you will definitely get on the show, but let me know if you're interested and I'll keep you in mind. Thanks, and now, back to the show. And we're back. So, Amtrak. As everybody knows, an Amtrak train in the Northeast Corridor going from D.C. to New York derailed in Philadelphia. 8 people killed, 100 and something injured, by the time you listen to this, you may know more, but as of now, what's clear is that the train was going over double the speed limit in that area. It was apparently accelerating in the last minute prior to the derailment, and just the brakes were slammed on in the last few seconds. The train was pretty much the engine survived. The driver survived. He's got a lawyer now, so he's lawyered up and isn't saying very much. The first passenger car was pretty much obliterated. And that's where
I'm looking at the pictures.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing that only 8 people died.
I mean, I think basically if you were in that front car, which was the business class car, I think that's where the deaths happened. And the further back you got in the train, the first passenger car was pretty much demolished. The car after that was off the tracks on its side. And if by the time you got to the back of the train, it was off the tracks, but still vertical. And so, I mean, you know, even if you were in the back of the train, this was a very violent event. This wasn't a happy thing to be a part of. The big damage was at the front of the train. And so, of course, people have been talking about all kinds of things here. First of all, the usual caveat with these things, train travel is much safer than a car, much safer than many other things. The kind of event is rare. It gets attention because it's a bunch of people all at once. It's not.
It should be rare.
It should be. I mean, for instance, it was mentioned there are various safety mechanisms that could have been in place to stop this.
As soon as I heard that this thing was going 100 miles an hour around a curve, immediately I thought, all right, human error. Why can't there be a GPS device in at the front of the train. It's like that, where it sets a maximum speed based or a governor based on its location. Simple device. And I could design something like that.
Well, and apparently there is a requirement that all trains in that northeast corridor, maybe even nationwide, are required to have such things. I believe the deadline was by the end of this year. But most places are behind in installing them. But the technology exists. It's out there. It's apparently expensive, so it's been taking a while to put them in place. But yeah, they're
expensive. Man, that's like, you could have an app on your phone that does that.
That's true. Well, I mean, except the, yes, yes, you could. I mean, and whatever they're doing with it, you know, cause they're probably not doing some sort of internet connected, blah, 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 GPS thing. They're probably putting all kinds of transponders on the track every, you know, 50 feet or something that they can control from some central network to say what the speed is right now. And then the trains have to have special receivers for them and all this kind of stuff. You know, you're right though. There's no reason you couldn't do it a lot cheaper, but of course they're not. It wasn't in place yet. And I even heard one story that, you know, it was tentatively in place in this part of the track, but just hadn't been turned on yet. But you know, and even in these situations, like, you know, is the driver able to override? There are all kinds of questions you come up, but yeah, this is clearly, you know, the three scenarios at this point that seem likely. I mean, I guess there is some chance, you know, of, you know, the throttle got stuck down or something like that, but chances are it's driver error of some sort. Either the driver fell asleep, or the driver was intentionally speeding up, doing this, you know, doing a suicide like the plane a few weeks ago,
Or didn't know, or wasn't with that paying, part of the track.
You just wasn't paying attention. I've seen some people speculating that maybe he was under the influence of something, and all of this is pure speculation at this point. We will eventually find out. But you know, any of those situations I just described, all preventable.
Yeah.
And it's just a question of what do you do in terms of having rules around these things, and how do you enforce it, and how much money are you willing to spend on it? And what are the trade-offs? And of course, a lot of people have made, have been trying to make political points over the last, you know, 2 days since this happened, in terms of, you know, general questions of infrastructure spending, or even specifically on Amtrak spending, because of course the Congress had the perfect timing to reject some Amtrak funding the day after this happened. You'd think at least they'd like delay the vote, even if you agree that we should cut Amtrak funding. You know, you'd think they'd think, you know, maybe the timing is a little off on this. Let's put it off a month.
Yeah, it's been bleeding money ever since it's existed in the 70s.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Amtrak has always been run essentially as a charity. It's the tax dollars going to subsidize something that is not able to be profitable on its own, and it was originally created, of course, because the whole passenger rail industry was collapsing across the country, and the government thought it was useful to retain some sort of passenger rail service and not let it collapse entirely. But I think you can
have. What about the horse and buggy industry? Has that been preserved by the government?
I want
my horse and buggy ride to my work. I think that would be very quaint.
The thing here is, I think you can have a separate argument on the desirability of public funding for rail. And there are all kinds of issues, pros and cons on that. But I think it's fairly clear this was not a, you know, fundamentally an infrastructure issue. In the end, you know, the driver screwed up. You know, and yes, there were you could potentially have infrastructure that would have prevented this, but in the end, you have driver error. You know, well, probably, yeah,
it's,
probably.
And it's not just the driver. I think it's the whole system. The whole system needs to be blamed for this, because it could have been prevented with a simple technology. It could have if any normal, if this was a private company, they would be sued left and right, up and down. And I don't know what the legal issues are here, but I would think that since this is a government company, they will probably be sued.
It's in the same kind of state as the post office. It's actually a private company that's subsidized and has a government mandate. It's sort of like Freddie and Fannie and the post office. They're mm-hmm. quasi-public. So I'm sure there will be lawsuits here. They're not going to get out of that because it's not actually a government agency. It's just
subsidized. And who ends up paying for those lawsuits? The shareholders. Oh, no, that's the taxpayers. Sorry.
Yep.
You and I.
But yeah, I think it's not, you know, I think the piling on about the debate about infrastructure, you know, okay, there's a legitimate debate to be had here. I don't think I'm seeing a direct application from this accident, you know, and maybe I'm wrong. If it turns out that, you know, it was a mechanical problem because they weren't doing enough maintenance, because they were cutting costs, and it wasn't the driver. The driver did everything he could. Then, okay, if that turns out to be the case, then I grant you that the infrastructure funding issue is relevant here. But otherwise, I think that's a separate issue. Let's talk about it separately. There was a very specific set of scenarios that happened here.
Yep. Okay. Bring on the Hyperloop.
Elon Musk's Hyperloop. Yep. Yeah, there are all kinds of fun things. I mean, people always point out how much more advanced rail is in Europe and Japan, and why can't we be like that? And the answer often comes down to, well, fundamentally, the economics are different, the preferences of people are different. You know, and so it doesn't necessarily make sense that we have the same sort of structure as in those places. Now, having said that, would I like
densities?
Yeah. I mean, would I like it if there was a, you know, high speed coast to coast train or a train from, you know, up here in Washington State down to California or something that was a really nice train that went really, really fast? Yeah, that would be kind of cool. But, you know, you have to make the case that it's actually going to be useful. It's going to be cost effective. It's, you know, there are all kinds of arguments there. And I'm not sure that I've heard any that are super convincing at this point. I mean, if that kind of thing is going to happen, it's kind of going to happen on its own. And I don't think we're at the place where it, you know, it makes sense enough that people are doing it on their own. So,
yep.
Okay. Let's take another break and then we'll talk a little bit about various goings on in the 2016 presidential race. Back after this.
Information.
Okay, during the break, Bruce asked me if I found my bell.
Oh!
There's my bell.
Wow.
I have not actually used it so far, but I did find my bell. I don't know which of the two bells this is. I found this one just about an hour before we recorded the show. Under my desk, buried underneath a pile of papers that had been taken out of the bag that I used for work. And in fact, they were, you know, a document that this morning for a meeting at work I was looking for and going, where is that? I know I printed it out and put it in my bag and I couldn't find it this morning. And it turns out because it had been used by my son as camouflage, I guess, to hide my bell underneath my desk under some papers. So anyway, I have indeed found one of the two bells. I don't know where the other one is at the moment, but he's gotten into the habit lately of taking various things, hiding them, and then challenging me to go find them. But then if I don't find them within 5 minutes, then, you know, he sort of loses interest in that, and I don't never see the thing again. And every once in a while, I'll find something. So I ordered the most recent thing beside the bell is I realized that I no longer had any pens in my office, you know, just typical office pens, because presumably various people, not just my son, but like my wife and my daughter come in and take the pens. And so I ordered some new pens and they arrived. They came in a box. I opened it up. I said, "Ooh, my pens got here." And within seconds, he snagged the pens and he's running upstairs, hiding them somewhere. I haven't seen them since, you know, and it's like a $5 pack of pens or whatever, but I'm like, I still have no pens now.
Yeah, I know how it is. Things like pens, for us, cordless phones, they all tend to like congregate in one spot in the house, and you know, everywhere, you know, and you need to have it, and at my desk or at my bed, and I can't ever find a pen, and they're all in the kitchen or whatever. That's just, you know.
Yes, exactly. So someday I'll find the pens, or I'll probably just give up and order some more. But anyway. So the big thing in the presidential race this week was Jeb Bush was asked a question about the Iraq war. And you'd think, by the way, that this is something that Jeb Bush would have been thinking about for the last couple years and practiced heavily. How am I going to react to questions about the Iraq war? Because, of course, you know this is going to come up. It's going to come up in the primary process. It's going to come up in the general election because, you know, his brother was responsible for the Iraq war. He was in support of it at the time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you'd think he'd be very well practiced on this. Now, the actual question asked initially was, if you knew then what you know now, would you have invaded Iraq? Now, this is one of those questions where, okay, the natural answer here is hindsight is 20/20. Knowing what I know now, I probably wouldn't have gone in. But you don't have that luxury. You have to make the decisions based on the information you have. And, you know, and assuming he wanted to support his brother's position on this, and given what was known at the time, I did support and I would still support the war. That's a fairly natural answer. And I haven't practiced that answer. And I could probably make that even more compact and better than I just did it. But then it's, you know, okay, next. Or even like, you know, I've seen people suggest a compact version of it that, you know, I don't have a time machine. Sorry. Move on. Look. But what he actually said, first of all, he's start off by sort of not answering that question, but instead answering the question of, you know, at the time, given what was known, what would I do? Which is a reasonable way to redirect the question if you've made it clear that you're redirecting the question, but he sort of munged it. So it was all sort of confusing and what was he doing and was he answering? And then over the course of the next 3 days, as people started calling him on this, he started, you know, flip-flopping and going back and forth and trying to clarify and saying he misunderstood the question and all of this kind of stuff.
He said that he was like, he didn't want to offend the troops.
Yeah. The third iteration of this was that he thought that answering the question would be offensive to the troops. And of course, the only way it would actually be offensive is if you agreed it was a mistake. But although even then, there's a good argument that says if it was a mistake, the right thing to do is come clean about it. And that's actually the best way to, you know, honor the troops, is to prevent the same kind of thing from happening in the future. But anyway, his latest version is, yes, if I knew then what I knew now, I would not have invaded. He said that earlier today, as we're recording this. And look, the problem with this is not what his actual answer is. I mean, you know, people are going to agree or disagree on whether the war was a good idea at the time, whether it's a good idea, you know, whether even knowing what we know now, it's a good idea. But it's that he completely and totally flubbed this thing and spent 3 days spinning around on this, trying to figure out the right thing to say. And it's...
Well, yeah, it's been a long time since he's really been in the public realm. I mean, it's he's only when was the last time he ran an election? Was it 2002?
Something like that. I don't know exactly.
Yeah. So he's going to have to up his game for all these questions that the reporters are asking, and that's another one of the things you wanted to mention. He's got a, this other thing is like the very follow-up question is, well, if it was the wrong thing to do, then was it a mistake? And of course, it's common belief now, or at least the majority polled Americans believe that the war was a mistake.
Well, and it's been mentioned, even if you poll diehard Republicans on this, and they agree. And in fact, they were trying to find a number of news organizations were trying to find some prominent Republican office holder who would actually come out and say, yes, even knowing what I know now, I still think it was a good idea to do the invasion, and I still would have done it. And so far, the only person they've found is Bolton, former Ambassador Bolton, who's willing to say that. And nobody else, even the other prominent Republicans. Now,
even John McCain.
Even John McCain. Like, even those folks are backing off from it. Now, that's different, by the way. Most of them will still say, knowing, you know, You didn't have that hindsight. You had to make a decision based on the information you actually had. And I believe we made the right call based on the information we had at the time.
Well, the information was there. They had to really stretch the evidence to make it fit. I mean, if you read the backstory behind that presentation at the UN by what's his name?
Colin
the
Powell.
Secretary of State at the time. Yeah, Powell. His deputy tells the story that they really had to stretch the evidence, and it was all Powell even at the time was saying, really, is this all we have?
Right.
And turned out to be, of course, false. And
there's a lot when you dig into the evidence about, you know, places where it should have been clear. And there were also a lot of apparently selective pressures where even when the folks lower down in the intelligence agencies absolutely knew something, it only the stuff that reflected a certain point of view was getting handed up the chain.
Yep.
And partially because the people up the chain made it clear that's what they wanted. You know, so there was a lot messed up there. I mean, but, you know, you could still argue that, OK, let's pretend that President Bush had no idea of all this stuff that was going on down below him and was only presented with the information that said this. Can we understand that? OK, maybe. But as you pointed out, even publicly, like, if you remember the debates happening at the time of the Iraq War, there were plenty of people out there saying, this is bullshit. We don't have this evidence. This is not clear. You had people, and of course the administration was poo-pooing people like the inspectors that were the UN inspectors who were actually in the country and stuff. But they were saying, you know, hey, this is the situation that's on the ground here. It's not what you're talking about at all. And of course, it turns out they were absolutely right. you know. Yeah. The administration was relying on sources with vested interests that wanted to go back into Iraq, that wanted the invasion. And they were lying to present their stories, you know, so...
Yep, and let's see. What I think a couple of weeks ago, related to this, Jeb was asked who was his foreign policy advisor, and he actually said that, "Oh, my brother." Like, really? He's going to admit that? I mean, if he's going to say that, I mean, the Republicans lost Congress and the White House because of the Iraq War. You think just for political self-interest?
Look at the polls on his brother's popularity, you know. And I recognize, okay, that's you know, a good loyal thing to say. Blah blah blah. At the very least, you know, pick some people who are in your brother's administration that you trust, not him mm-hmm. himself, just for the visibility of it, or punt the question. You know, but I mean, I give him this. You know, he probably gave a truthful answer, and it's nice to see a politician do that, but it's not an answer that's going to help him.
Yeah, I really have a hard time seeing how he is going to get any traction with the grassroots.
I think his whole strategy is he doesn't think he's going to get traction with the grassroots. He thinks he's going to get traction with other parts of the party, and he's going to get, you know, he's going to come in with a big money advantage, and he's going to go after the people who call themselves Republican but aren't the core diehard. They're not the quote-unquote base, but they do vote. And they do vote in these primaries, and if he can get them out to vote, he thinks that's his path. I mean, he's been quoted specifically as saying, sometimes you have to lose primaries to win the general. And so I think he's going for... Now, of course, if you lose too many primaries, you don't get to the general.
Yeah, exactly.
I think his strategy is to try to figure out a path to victory that does not require... going after the quote unquote Republican base, because he knows he can't get those.
Well, and, you know, there was a race in 2008, it's kind of similar to this, where you have one candidate who was relying on the primaries, another one that was relying on the caucuses, and the one who relied more on the caucuses that had the base, the, you know, the Democratic base, he's the one who won.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can kind of see how this might be playing on the Republican side too, where Bush may win on the primaries, like in Florida, maybe in New Hampshire, but when it comes to the caucus states, he's going to get nothing.
Well,
and
of course,
I know the rules, the delegate rules are very different, but
yeah. And one of the things that's been going on behind the scenes is that the delegate rules have been being changed over the last couple years, specifically to make it harder for a non-establishment candidate to win. They've been adding more rules in terms of, like, you know, that all kinds of shenanigans could go on at caucus states, and they're basically making that less true, so that even in a caucus state, which typically, you know, you there's a first round and you elect delegates, and then they go from your precinct level to a county level, from a county level to a state level, and at each level they elect delegates to the next level up. But they've adopted rules that say that regardless of which people you put in those spots, the proportions have to match the initial proportions on caucus day, on the first caucus day.
Yep.
And that also they're binding, so that if you get a delegate who doesn't seem like they're going to vote the way they're supposed to, the party can replace them. And even more than that, if you get all the way to the convention and they vote for somebody that they're not supposed to, you can toss them out at the spot at the convention and replace them somebody who votes the right way.
Yep.
And so that makes it a lot harder for sort of insurgent strategies based on caucuses to get anywhere. But we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I can definitely see the parallels that make Jeb Bush the Hillary Clinton this year, the 2008 Hillary Clinton. I still, you know, if I had to give odds here, I still would give a better shot for Jeb than any of the other candidates. But I want to be clear. I don't give him, like, you know, it's not like I give him a 60-70% shot. This is very wide open. You know, I maybe give him a 25% shot and the other guy's 20, you know? Mm-hmm. So he's got an advantage. I think he's got an advantage because of the money factor. He's got an advantage because, he can potentially, you know, do a broad-based, nationwide sort of appeal. But he's got a lot of disadvantages, and him staying in that sort of, I think he has an advantage spot, relies on him being a little bit more savvy than he has been so far, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, because like I said, when we started this segment, it's unbelievable to me that he did not, before he started even talking about this presidential race, spend time with some advisors coming up with, how are you going to answer the Iraq war question? And have something that he'd practiced over and over again so that he had it down. And when it came up, he could just handle it. It honestly seemed like, you know, he came into this like unprepared. It's like, how do you come into this unprepared?
And then what is it today that he accidentally said that he's running and...
it was a couple days ago. The reason this matters, by the way, and somebody, I forget who did a post that outlined this. He's actually being very smart by delaying his official announcement, because until he makes an official announcement, he can coordinate with the super PACs because he's not actually a candidate. And so he can do all the coordination he wants with the super PACs up until the day he announces, and then he's not allowed to talk to them anymore. And so it gives him a strategic advantage to delay announcing as long as possible. But I don't think he's going to be able to delay too much longer. I mean, another month maybe. But you know, come on, he's running. You know,
well, the debates will be coming up soon, and then he'll have to be declared by then. But and I think that when it comes, I think the debates will really be the way where you're really going to see, you know, whether he's going to have any traction.
Well, and there's a lot of question there too in terms of who do they decide to let get into debates, and by what criteria do they let them in? Because it's getting to the point they're way too many to have a reasonable debate with everybody on stage. Pataki just announced that he's going to be running, or he announced that he's going to announce. You know, mm-hmm. And there are several others in the wings that still haven't officially announced. And, you know, we're talking, you know, I don't know, 20, something like that at this point.
That's ridiculous. Well, yeah, I think there needs to be some sort of 5-10% criteria or something.
Right. And what people point out, of course, is that at this point, if you do any sort of criteria based on polling, you're basically just making the decision based on name recognition only. And, you know, whereas some of these people who are lower on feel like, well, the way they're going to break in is at the debates.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But, I mean, there can be like one debate where it includes like everybody. And where they basically get all they're going to have time is to introduce themselves and say a few things about their positions, and that's it.
Well,
then they'll win and went down.
It has not been structured this way, but I saw someone on Twitter make the suggestion, because somebody asked, you know, hey, is there a system that you could actually have that could deal with this many candidates? And the answer was brackets. And you could actually have something, and you might not necessarily have a brackets where you pick winners to go on to the next level, but you could do something like the first few debates. Don't try to have everybody. You know, you've got 20 candidates, do 5 at a time. And then by the time you've done that for everybody once, then it'll be clearer who's actually in the lead. And now the second round, you can pick the people who are at the top on the polls. you know, or something like that. But that's not how they're structuring it. That's not what they're going to do. But it was a smart idea, I thought. You know, when you've got this many candidates, to do something like that.
Yeah, I just... Because the problem is, you know, people... you can imagine people going and saying, oh, why isn't Bush there? He's not in the debate. Did he drop out?
Yeah. You certainly could see that. And we're over time, but I wanted to mention one other thing on this before closing up this question or this topic. There was also an issue where some reporter just thought he'd be clever and do a gotcha question. And he decided to ask, I believe it was five or six of the Republican candidates, and I am negligent and I didn't bring it up, asked them each to name their favorite living president. Or president or ex-president. And of course, that gives you, you know, Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Obama to pick from. So three Republicans and two Democrats. So when you're asking, or the other way around, three Democrats and two Republicans. So, of course, if you're asking the Republican candidates this, they're not going to pick Jimmy Carter or Obama or Clinton. It's just not going to happen. So you're basically asking them to pick which President Bush they liked best. And of course, both of them are extremely dangerous to answer. Because the policies of the older George Bush are not popular in the current Republican Party particularly. He's much too moderate for them. He was much too pragmatic on a bunch of issues. I liked him. I liked him a lot.
Got to be prudent.
Got to be prudent. I frankly thought that was a really good motto, but, you know, whatever. And of course, George W. Bush, as we were talking about in terms of his brother, was it left office incredibly unpopular because of the Iraq War. Answering either one of those is potentially problematic to all these Republican candidates. And so what happened is, I believe, four out of the five candidates answered, were asked this question, actually answered Ronald Reagan, who is, of course, not alive and has not been for over a decade. I think he died in 2004 or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of them acknowledged that he's not actually alive. They said, well, actually, a recently living president, Ronald Reagan, or something like that. And then one of the candidates, I believe it was actually Santorum or somebody, said, well, it would have to be one of the Bushes. I thought that was just amusing that they did that. It's a no-win question, and it's not really a particularly meaningful question. I just was very amused by that.
Yeah, I want to see how Jeb answers that.
He was not one of the ones asked that question, unfortunately. I honestly feel like he's probably closer to his father than his brother in foreign policy, at least. But I don't know that for sure. Like, there's a lot. I'm not quite sure about where he really stands on a bunch of things. So I don't know.
Yeah. We'll never know until the bombs are flying.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, there are domestic issues as well. And, I honestly don't have a great picture of him. You were in Florida while he was governor, I believe. So you probably have a better idea.
Actually, to tell you the truth, I thought he was a good governor. I actually think he did a good job on domestic policy there, within the state. But again, my top issue is foreign policy and human rights and torture and stuff. And I think that I'm sure that he would be every bit as much of a warmonger as his brother. So
there you go. Well, we're done with this segment. We went a bit long again. We're going to take a break and we'll come back with a quick lightning round. Back after this.
Begin.
Creepy
classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, we are back. It is the lightning round. We are going to do alternating 2-minute segments. Bruce, do you have the list in front of you?
Yes.
Okay, I will start, and here we go. So first of all, I just wanted to mention, and this is a quick thing, we have had a number of conversations spurring from the show. I'm not going to read them out as feedback, but if you go to our Facebook page, on the May 2nd post, there was some discussion about following up on the issue of STEM education versus humanities and CMU versus MIT. And then there was also a Twitter discussion. If you look at the conversations between Yvonne and myself with one of our listeners who followed up on our conversation about not having seen an Apple Watch yet and some comments about Google Glass, and we had some discussions there. So if you're interested in discussions following up from the show, check us out on Facebook, check us out on Twitter. There's conversation happening there. Feel free to jump in. So that's my first topic. Your turn.
Okay. The NSA court case. There was I don't have all the details in front of me. I thought I had a tab open for it, but there was a challenge to the NSA bulk data collection program, where they're collecting all the metadata for all calls in the entire country. That was ruled by this appeals court as being not that it was unconstitutional, but that it did not follow the actual intent of the Patriot Act. And that and then the timing of this is interesting because of the Freedom Act, the USA Freedom Act, which is supposed to be a scaling back of the Patriot Act, but it actually preserves the bulk data collection. It just changes the location of where the data is stored and how long it is kept, and also the reauthorization of the expiring portions of the Patriot Act at the end of this month. So all this is kind of like churning, happening at the same time as we get close to the end of the month, and it'll be interesting to see how this goes. And it'll probably be a major topic for your discussion for your podcast next week as the deadline gets near.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, one of the things I see here on these, and I only a few seconds left to talk about this, I still don't remain convinced that, you know, anything passed by Congress is going to make a significant difference. One way or another, they'll sort of end up with something that may make some changes on the surface, but doesn't fundamentally change any of the big problems. We'll see, though. I mean, there's at least some indication that, there's just not the will to reenact some of the stuff. The question is, are there specific things that don't get reenacted, things that are actually the ones that matter? Mm-hmm. So, there, I got to ring the bell.
The bell.
Okay. Next up, I read a book. I finished a book. excuse me. So I just wanted to mention, it was again an Audible book, an audio book on Audible, I should say. It's The Selfish Gene by Dawkins, which is a famous book originally published in the late 1970s. Second edition came out in the 80s, and then the more changes in the 30th anniversary edition. For those of you who are not familiar with having heard of the book, I'd never read it, but I'd heard about it for years. It's basically, the main point of it is looking at evolution from the perspective saying that it's not individuals who are the sort of inherent unit that carries evolutions, it's genes. And in some cases, even more fundamental units than genes. that are carrying this, and essentially bodies and animals are just, essentially vehicles that the genes travel in and control. And it's really all up to the genes. It's very fascinating. He is also the book that introduced the concept of a meme, which is the sort of mental equivalent of a gene. And the one thing I will say about the experience of this book, I mentioned that there was an original edition, there was a second edition, and then there were more changes made for the 30th anniversary of this book. I really wish he'd just written a second book or something, because the actual effect of this, especially in an audiobook, was he sort of intermingled all of these things. So it was sort of like, here's stuff that was in the original book. Here's additions I made in the second edition. And here are endnotes I added for the third edition. And they're all intermingled, and they're all, he tried to do some things with, like, you know, some things he read directly, some things an actor read, and some things he said, you know, introduced by saying, this is an endnote, you know, and it sort of led for a confusing experience as an audiobook, at least at first. I sort of got into the rhythm of it about halfway through the book. But it's still, it's sort of a seminal book with a very key concept that is convincing in many ways and very interesting and part of the sort of fundamental dialogue on these issues. Definitely a book worth reading, although it's at times it gets a little academic and such, and this guy is also known in his later writings. He gets he's well known as one of these sort of militant atheist folks. But there's actually very little of, which I don't mind, frankly, but there's very little of that in this book particular. There are a few paragraphs where he really gets into that. But for the most part, you can not worry about that part. But very interesting. I would say it's worth reading or listening to. Okay, I passed my time. Your turn.
Okay, the Trans-Pacific Partnership,
yes,
is a trade deal. Basically, most of the major economies in the Pacific Rim, except for China, and President Obama is trying to get what's called Trade Promotion Authority, which is basically the authority to negotiate the trade deal and have that make the trade bill be an up or down vote in Congress, rather than the Congress having to debate every little item in the trade deal. So this trade deal, the details are classified.
Yep.
And not just classified for the public, but even classified for Congress. The only way that they are allowed to look at it, but they have to go into a special room. They are allowed to take notes, but they cannot take their notes with them, and they have to sign a non-disclosure agreement. So basically, they're doing everything they can to make sure the public does not know the details of this.
Meanwhile, a lot of people at a variety of major corporations have access to this.
Oh, okay. And so it makes it very hard for many senators to want to vote for this thing when it's so secret.
I will add one key thing here, that according to some of what has leaked about this agreement, part of the agreement is not just that the terms can't be released while they're in negotiation, because you can actually make a reasonable argument that, hey, we're in the process of negotiating, it has to be private while we're negotiating, but, you know, then we'll make it public and before it gets voted on, right? But apparently, according to what's being negotiated, not only can't it be made public before it's voted on, it can't be made public for 4 years after it goes into effect.
Oh, gee. That's ridiculous. So that's so anti-democratic.
And of course, a lot of what this thing apparently does, again, according to the leaks, WikiLeaks put out a draft version of this, is various things that restrict the members' government's ability to sort of make their own decisions on all kinds of things. And basically, it's very much tilted in favor of giving all kinds of abilities for specifically transnational corporations to get what they want and ensure that regulations are as consistent as possible between countries. But what that ends up being is that each one of the countries has to give up the rights to be able to make their own independent decisions on a variety of these issues, because any one of the countries can sort of sue, or the companies can sue to say, you know, what this country is doing is, you know, damaging to my business, and therefore it has to be undone. All kinds of crazy things like this. So I think there's, this is one of the issues where there's a lot of actual, you know, they're both Democrats and Republicans who are very wary of this thing.
And it was the Democrats that caused it to fail in the Senate today.
Yeah, and so we'll see. But apparently it's not dead yet. Even the fast track isn't dead yet. And so there's a lot left to be written on this thing. But from everything I've read about it, it sounds like a horrible deal all the way around. And the way that it's being conducted is bad, too. And the way that, you know, okay, a whole bunch of big companies have a seat at the table, but the general public isn't allowed to know anything. Come on. That's just not the way we should be doing things.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess it's my turn. Facebook hosting news. Facebook has made a deal with a bunch of major news publishers to basically host their news stories for them. So the main idea is you're on Facebook, specifically on the mobile app. You're on the mobile app and somebody shares a story or you see a story, you click on it. Instead of going out to say the New York Times website or BuzzFeed's website and seeing the stuff there, it just lives in Facebook and you see the article directly in there. The argument is it makes load times a lot better because they're going to be doing some tricks like preloading it in the background while you're looking at the thing your friend shared in case you click on it, all kinds of fun things like that. But this potentially has a lot of implications to the publishing industry because it gives Facebook a lot of control. I mean, Facebook already has a lot of control because a number of these news folks have published statistics that say, you know, at this point, a majority of their traffic comes from articles shared on Facebook rather than people who actually go to the news site directly. And so Facebook is going to have a huge amount of control over, you know, maybe this article isn't that great. So we won't include that. We don't want you to include that one. Or even if they're not that heavy handed, of course, you got their algorithm of whether or not it gets shown or anything like that. So there's been a lot of hand wringing in the news industry about, you know, are these news companies sort of making a deal with the devil that, you know, may get them better traffic right now? But they're going to come to regret it in, you know, 5-10 years. I don't know. I think honestly, those companies are in bad shape anyway because the trends are against, you know, it's a few news junkies that actually go directly to news sites. The vast majority of people see stuff because their friends share it on Facebook or whatever, and that's it. So if your business model is reliant on getting people directly to your site, you're in trouble. And so I can see why they're tempted by these kinds of things.
And there's a lot of clickbait out there too.
There's certainly a lot of clickbait out there, and anyway, we'll see. You know, the content business is one that is having a really hard time figuring out how to successfully monetize in the current internet world in a way other than crappy clickbait articles. The question is not how to generate those kinds of articles, because those are, you can hire really cheap people to do that. The question is, how will, you know, in-depth investigative reporting or adversarial reporting get funded in the future? And that's, I think, a very open question. Okay. Yep. Your turn.
All right, this will have to be my last one.
Okay.
I'm scraping the bottom of the barrel here.
Yeah, we got
Verizon is one buying more for you AOL. And one for me.
Yep.
Okay.
Verizon and AOL.
Yep. So $4.4 billion. I can't believe it. I didn't even know that AOL was still a thing. And it's like, and it says here that there's still 2.1 million people who use AOL dial-up.
Yes.
Isn't that unbelievable? Back in the 90s. Yeah. And they're still paying like $20 a month for that.
Yep.
So,
I remember personally, I kept my AOL dial-up for years after I rarely used it, because there was a time period where if I traveled, that was the one reliable way I could, you know, get online from almost anywhere. But I mean, even so, I gave that up a really long time ago at this point. But, you know, and what's mentioned is, you know, there are 2.1 million people with dial-up, but a significant number of those people don't necessarily actually use it. There are a lot of people who just pay the $20 a month and are barely even aware they still have it.
Nice business. You can get it.
Exactly. So anyway, but apparently that's, you know, that's not what AOL was bought for. They own a bunch of content companies. They own Huffington Post. They own a bunch of other stuff. And apparently the big draw here was actually advertising technology that they own.
That's new. And it's funny, I'm reading this quote, it says, "I think this is absolutely a time period almost like at the beginning of the web. There are years where everything changes, and I think we're in one of those time periods right now." Come on. Really?
Well, like... and speaking of AOL, it ties back into what I was just saying about Facebook, because Facebook's essentially trying to recreate the walled garden that companies like AOL had, you know, decades ago, where they try to make people stay within their world as much as humanly possible. Facebook doesn't want people clicking links to go to the outside web. They want people staying in Facebook for everything. But anyway, we'll see. I mean, AOL, like you said, AOL's still around, still getting money from those dial-up accounts.
Yeah.
Okay. One last one for me. And I know this is one of your favorite topics as well. There was a Google released some statistics about their self-driving cars and how often they've gotten into accidents. At first, someone was reporting this initially, I guess, trying to be scandalous about, you know, hey, the Google cars have actually been in some accidents. Oh, scary. And then Google came out with more information, basically saying that there'd been something like, you know, a handful of accidents. None of which the self-driving cars were responsible for out of 11 million miles driven. And they were all, none of the accidents were serious. They were little fender benders. The majority were caused by, you know, were the fault of the other party. And the handful that weren't, were when a human being was actually driving the Google car instead of the AI.
Wow.
I think these
features are creeping into the cars. I mean, I'm in the market for buying a car sometime in about a year.
Yeah.
And I really want to have a car that's got self-driving features. I really want to be able to, when I get in bumper traffic on the highway, I want to be able to just sit back and not have to pay attention, because it's like, and it's getting to that point. I mean, the new CRV has that right now.
And well, one interesting thing that Tesla announced, besides their battery stuff and other things, a few weeks back, was that they were pushing out an over-the-air software upgrade to Tesla cars that were already on the road, adding some self-driving capability, basically to you know, stay in the lane during highway driving kind of stuff. You know, which is, you know, not full automated driving, but is, you know, you're moving in that direction.
Well, later this year they're going to have full automated driving. Right.
Yeah, I think it's still highway only in some restrictions. Okay. But again, the interesting part to me about that was they're pushing it out through a software update. It's not you don't have to go buy a new car. The car you already have, you're going to get in your car one day and it's going to go bing, new software update. You can now just say go to work, you know?
Yeah.
So and not quite that good, because they don't have the sensors necessary to fully do that, but getting there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the stats on the crashes just reinforced to me the idea that, hey, these things are actually going to be significantly safer than people driving their own car. So all of the, oh my God, the Google cars were in a crash. Okay. Yeah, they were in a crash, but given the number of miles they drove, they were in a lot fewer crashes and a lot less serious crashes than if human beings had been driving for those same 11 million miles. So we're going in exactly the right direction here. We're going pretty fast in that direction. The obstacles are all going to be sort of, you know, legislative and how does insurance work and how nervous are people about letting their cars do this kind of stuff. And, you know, how much do people want to retain that control? And from my point of view, I don't want to retain that control at all. I want to be able to get in my car, tell it where to go, and sit down and read a book.
Yeah, it's going to be a major revolution. I mean, we could talk a lot more about this, but I'm really looking forward to that world where autonomous driving is there.
Okay, and that's the show. So thanks again, Bruce, for joining us. Do you want to point people to you on the net or anything like that?
Yeah, my Twitter is BYUFan, and my blog is contrarianconformist.blogspot.com, and I guess those are the best ways to get a hold of me.
There you go.
See my stuff.
And check out Bruce's stuff. And as usual, if you want to get a hold of me, go to our Facebook page, comment on the post there about this show. We'd love to hear from you there, or contact me on Twitter. I'm at Abelsme, ABULSME. Or if you prefer email, it's abelsme@abelsme.com. We love to hear from you. And, you know, all the other stuff I always say, tell your friends, share us online, all of this kind of stuff. We love to hear from you guys, and we love when you expand our reach and let new people know about us. So thanks, everybody, and thanks one more time, Bruce, and have a good week, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye.